Here on Radio 4 FM, it's time for our Book of the Week, which concludes Tracy Thorne's memoir, Bedsit Disco Queen. Everything But the Girl, the band created by Tracy Thorne and her husband Ben Watt, had experienced a dip in their fortunes in the late 1980s. But in 1995, a remix of their song Missing became a surprise dance floor hit and shot the couple straight back to stellar success.
We'd been working pretty much solidly for the last 3 years. Recording, touring, promoting.
I step off the train, I'm walking down your street again, and past your door.
If it hadn't been for our resurrection, I don't imagine we would have carried on at such a furious rate.
It's years since you've been there.
Becoming unexpectedly cool again was a blast, but still, dragging ourselves out of the deep, dark hole we'd fallen into had been time-consuming and exhausting. Though I felt rejuvenated, I wasn't actually getting any younger. I was 35 years old, and though I'm loath to reduce myself to a magazine cliché, my biological clock was ticking. March 1997, and I'm in a hotel room in Perth. I've just been told by Ben that we've been offered the support slot on the upcoming U2 stadium tour of America. U2 at this point are also going through a period of dance floor inspired reinvention, so I can see why they've made the connection. Everyone around us is beside themselves with excitement at the prospect. This is the kind of opportunity people pay for, and we have just been handed it on a plate. This time, though, I think Ben really is going to leave the decision up to me. I think he knows that I'm the one with the strongest feelings about what has to happen next. I'm really glad the phone call came in, but here's what I say. Actually, babe, do you know what? I think I want to stop now. January 1998, less than a year later. I'm lying on a table in the operating theatre, about to give birth to twins by caesarean section. I've had an epidural, which has taken hold down one side of my body better than the other. This will prove to be less than ideal towards the second half of the procedure, when I'm being stitched up again. There will be tears, both of joy at the arrival of these, our first children, and also of pain. It will be the most memorable day of my life so far, and one I would happily revisit at a moment's notice. But the one thing that is marring this otherwise perfect moment is the fact that in the heat of the moment, I've forgotten to bring a CD with me to the hospital, forgotten to bring any music of any kind. And then, also in the heat of the moment, I have agreed that the nurse can choose a CD to put on. And she has selected some kind of compilation, possibly entitled 100 Songs You Most Love to Hate, so that as my first child enters the world, and bear in mind that I am someone to whom music has always been of some importance, the song that is playing is Where Do You Go To, My Lovely, by Peter Sarstedt. I'd always sworn that I would be a non-neurotic, very laid-back mother. My babies would sleep in a drawer. I wouldn't obsessively sterilise everything. They'd eat whatever we ate. And I would get on with my life exactly the same, just with a baby strapped to my back. But now I had two actual, real babies to care for. Two small, premature baby girls. I felt responsible for these little people to a degree I simply hadn't anticipated, and the idea of handing them over to nannies while I got on with my career was all of a sudden unthinkable. We tried to come up with a compromise, play festivals instead of touring. That way we could reach a large audience in a short space of time, reducing the travelling and the time away from home. So we played at the Roskilde Festival in Denmark, and then the Montreux Jazz Festival, taking the girls with us and staying in a beautiful hotel overlooking the lake. That little trip was actually quite enjoyable. It was only spoiled by the fact that I began to feel sick the morning after the gig. On the way home, at the airport, I felt worse, sick and faint. It passed as the day wore on, but the next morning I woke up and felt sick again. 8 months later, our son Blake was born, and that gig at Montreux in July 2000 became the last gig I did. Once I had disengaged from the music business, I began to relish living a more completely anonymous life. The kids weren't used to me working, or familiar with my identity as a pop star, and so they would be completely baffled on those occasions when someone would come up and ask for an autograph. They would look bewildered and ask, "What are you writing on that bit of paper, Mummy? But why? Why does that lady want your name written down?" Like all mums, I sang to my kids at home, so they knew what my voice sounded like. And once, when I walked into a branch of Gap, pushing Blake in a pushchair, Missing was playing loudly. He twisted round to look at me, little finger pointing upwards towards the source of the music. "Mummy," he exclaimed in a tone of pure amazement, "you were singing in the shop." The kids found it slightly confusing and strange, but above all, just not that interesting. It wasn't who I was to them. Tracy Thorn was someone they didn't know, who seemed to belong to strangers. Meanwhile, I was Mum. I wasn't always sure whether the other mums knew who I was or what my job had been before. Often it wasn't discussed at all, and so I assumed my anonymity was complete. But it was sometimes a bit like living in disguise, wondering whether at any moment my cover would be blown. I remember when the kids were very small, standing outside school with a group of mums, talking about teachers and playdates and school dinners, when suddenly a huge gleaming Range Rover with black tinted windows slowed and then pulled over to the side of the road. The window whirred down and a voice called out, "Tracy! Tracy, hi, how are you?" In unison, all heads turned towards the car and the familiar face that leaned out, the stubble and sunglasses confirming the almost unbelievable fact that, yes, it was George Michael. People asked, "Do you miss singing now that you don't do it anymore?" I'd laugh and answer in complete honesty, "No, not at all." Until suddenly, one day, I really, really did. I missed it badly and couldn't imagine why I'd stopped. So when, at more or less that precise moment, I was sent yet another request to sing a vocal over a dance track, I was primed to give a different answer to the usual blanket, "No thanks." The track that Ali and Basti Schwartz, aka T. Schwartz, sent me was a dark, moody piece of electro house that inspired me to write the first song I had come up with in 5 years. Ben recorded the vocal for me in our studio at home. It felt good. It felt totally familiar, easy. I liked the paraphernalia of it all. The putting on and adjusting of the headphones, setting up the vocal level, adjusting the reverb. I thought, I know how to do this. And it was like rediscovering a craft that had lain dormant for too long. The song, Damage, came out in June 2006, and doing this one small project flicked a switch inside my head back to on. I came up with the brilliant plan that I would make a solo record. It was time for a bit of self-assertion again. I wanted to make a statement that I was still that girl who'd gone and bought an electric guitar, aged 16, and formed bands. The record I ended up making, Out of the Woods, was more of a pop record than those beginnings would ever have led you to imagine. In the middle of 2006, with the record half finished, I went to have a meeting with Virgin, still my record company, despite the years of silence, to tell them what I was doing. Tony Wadsworth, the label boss, sat and listened patiently while I told him that I was making a solo album but didn't want to tour or appear in videos or do much in the way of promotion. He'd had the same conversation with Kate Bush when her album Ariel had come out the year before, so he must have wondered why on earth all his female artists were suddenly becoming hermits. But to his credit, he agreed that I could do what I wanted and they'd put the record out on those terms. By December, Out of the Woods was finished and ready for release, and I was halfway back to the old life. For the last few years, I'd spent much of the time in a fairly dressed-down state, and here I was again with a stylist and a rail of the latest clothes, having my makeup done for me. It was like a mum's spa weekend dream come true, not a job at all. I realised at once that I wouldn't want to go back to it full time, but that, to dip into, it was the perfect antidote to midlife melancholy. February 2007. I'm 44 years old. It's 9 in the morning, and I'm being driven through the gates of Pinewood Studios. The driver points out to me a kind of huge aircraft hangar over to our right. That's the James Bond stage, he says. I'm here to do a filmed ident for a television channel. The theme of this one is, guess what, female singers, and I'm here to be filmed both on my own and then in a group setting. Lady Sovereign is the one I warm to. She is probably the youngest of all of us and is clearly feeling a little out of place. But even in her discomfort, she's sharp and funny. We're all in frocks and heels. She's in streetwear, ponytail scraped tightly to one side. She's twitching and fidgeting, worried she looks no good, uncertain as to what this kind of thing means, how it will make her appear. The camera pans round from behind her, catching her in close-up from the side. "Don't film me from the side, man," she complains. "I look like a peanut. Side of my head, man, it looks bald." "No, no," says the director, "you look nice." "Nice," she wails, "I feel like Gollum." My heart goes out to her in her self-consciousness and self-doubt and inability to go with the flow, her determination to let everyone know that she is more than this. I remember feeling like that, trying to act tough, coming over as edgy and angry, because you're trying to deal with the anxiety about what it all means, whether you're going to be understood or misunderstood. The constant alertness and the attention trying to dodge the pitfalls. I'm not so much like that anymore. I'm easier in my own skin, finally. But for so many years, I was like that. I identify with her completely. And at the same time, I feel like her mum. And I quite like the feeling.
See, I'm the one in charge now. What happened to me? I turn into someone's mother. Really someone should give me a uniform. Or someone should show me where is the door. Someone should come round and explain how it is that love forgets to speak its name.
Tracy Thorne was reading from her memoir Bedsit Disco Queen. It was abridged by Alison Joseph and produced by Allegra McElroy. And you can catch up with previous episodes on the Radio 4 website. After the news, it's Woman's Hour. But first, it's 10 years since the invasion which toppled the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And earlier this week, the BBC correspondent Hugh Sykes reported on how everyday life has changed over the past decade in a country where security, education, water and electricity can never be taken for granted.
Karabakh, Maku.
Two of the first words that I learned in Iraq, Karabakh, Maku. Electricity, there isn't any. And I still hear them all the time. Geriatric power stations, damaged by neglect and by Western sanctions, have never managed to keep up with demand.
You can still hear After Saddam on the BBC Radio 4 website.